Welcome to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby from the Grape Nation. Today we're broadcasting live from Charleston Wine and Food. We want to thank Ben's friends for making our coverage today possible. This afternoon we're focusing on conversations on building a sustainable lifestyle and finding balance in the hospitality industry. Big thanks to Charleston Wine and Food Festival for having HRN down here for the fifth year in a row. My guest today is Harry Root. Harry owns a business called Grassroots Wine right down here in the Charleston area, and he has other offices. Harry, you've been in the business a couple of decades already, right?
Almost, pretty much 2 decades.
Yeah, even though you look young. You started Grassroots in the early 2000s. Good wine, and both of us love good wine. Great wine. It doesn't get to the consumer in a market like this without guys like you. And maybe now it's taken a little for granted, but talk to me a little about the business, the distribution, how you got started, you know, why you did this. You know, I'm assuming because it was a lack of great wine or...
Sure. I mean, well, the original way we got into the business was we opened up what we thought was going to be a liquor barn in Chattanooga.
Okay.
And as it turns out, there was one thing, it's a lot more fun to sell wine than liquor, in my opinion. But also there was a very big, literal thirst for great wine in that city that really hadn't been exposed to it before. So we were very successful in our store, made great friends, realized how much consumers really wanted to learn more about what they were drinking, and were into the sense of place that really excited us right from the very beginning. And we eventually sold that store and started a distribution company called Grassroots, first in Alabama in 2003, and then a year later in South Carolina in 2004, kind of following the model we did with the store of taking risks, of trying to work as directly as we could with producers, especially from Europe, and bringing new, interesting wines to the market that weren't there before.
So what happens? Do you literally go to Europe and see if you could represent people, or are those people represented through importers in New York? And I don't know if it's the right word, but you sub-distribute or import?
Yeah, I mean,
both?
That's a fine way to put it. I am definitely a middleman in a lot of ways.
Right.
At the beginning, it was mostly importers, and that was almost strictly the way business was done. And we were very lucky to come around when we did, and working in two states that were kind of flying under the radar as far as exposure. But we were also very, very adventurous, very, very early. So we worked with Neil Rosenthal and Terry Thies. And the
but those are like the OGs of
the
curated
gangsters.
Wines and, you know, natural and all that stuff.
Exactly. And they weren't represented in our two markets. And we were, you know, especially in Charleston, we were very lucky to be here before anybody really knew what this town would become.
And well, that was sort of my next question. 2003, 4, 5, when you were getting up and running, it's nothing like what's going on today, right?
Oh, not at all.
But there was some interest and growth in restaurants then, too.
Very much so, and the food was changing. Fig, for example, opened up the same year that we did here in Charleston, and we have a great relationship with that restaurant group in particular. But generally speaking, any kind of young entrepreneurs that in Charleston had the opportunity between the affordability at the time of space and the access to lots of tourists that were already coming here anyway, and then the burgeoning food scene, it made sense to tie wine into that in a new way. And so, what we were doing was somewhat risky, bringing wines from Austria. And
let's talk about that
sort of thing.
Because two questions. In a sense, do you think you were breaking some ground then? Like when you look left and right, there were not a lot of guys going to Austria or whatever. And then, you know, your company has a certain philosophy, or it's important to you when you go after wines or wineries or winemakers that they kind of fit in a certain box.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about, you know, both of those things.
Well, so, like I say, in a lot of ways, we were in the right place at the right time. And when we did open up, there was that piece of the wine world didn't really exist at all anywhere, really. I mean, it was barely happening in New York.
Starting to grow.
And we were really lucky to make friends with the right people at the right time. So, you know, our peers in New York City were doing the same things that we were doing in South Carolina almost exactly at the same time. They were able to be a little bit more successful faster just because they're bigger and had a bigger audience and a more progressive audience.
Right.
But restaurants changed quickly. I mean, for one thing, it's a better experience for their consumers, for sure. And then the other thing is it's another way really to differentiate yourself and create profit centers by finding wines that don't exist elsewhere, and you can, you know, you become, it's becoming where you're not competing on price for the Pinot Grigio placement.
Right.
Instead, you're offering the customer something they've never had before, and differentiating yourself, but also being able to make money.
And you were starting to get into it when you were talking about, you know, regions and makers. There's a certain type of wine and philosophy, you know, of the type of portfolio of wines that you want to bring in. Just quickly tell me.
Sure. You know, I mean,
I know it. I want you to know.
Well, it's evolved in real time, you know, honestly, as we've been open. I've had overt conversations with people about this from the beginning, even before we started talking about natural wine. We were trying to figure out, what is it about these wines that we like so much? What do we even call them? And how do we even describe them? And they would change year from year. It might be, it's got to be hand harvested. But then the next year, it's like, wait a minute.
Organic.
You know,
or whatever.
You know, what about the sulfur? Or what about the agriculture?
Right.
And you know, all those things are important.
That was evolving, right?
Well, absolutely. And it still is. And there's not necessarily one right way to find interesting wines that people love and that kind of fit the philosophy. So the philosophy does have to be flexible. I grew up, when my parents divorced when I was 10 years old, my mom moved from Tampa, Florida to a hippie commune in Tennessee.
Wow.
And that kind of guided my the way that I select wines and the way that I find people that I want to work with. Because I grew up, you know, in the late 1970s, going to farmer's market, drinking raw milk, you know, playing in soybean silos and that sort of thing.
At that point, did you not know any better? Like there was like pasteurized milk in the supermarket, or you kind of knew both worlds?
Well, I knew.
Or that was the world you knew?
I knew when I went to go visit my father, who lived in Tampa and kind of lived normal, industrial.
So you had both sides, right?
And I didn't even really think about it too much at the time, except for I sure do like that milk in Tennessee better than I like the milk in Florida.
Not yet. All right, so that's grassroots. You're on the business side of the wine business, and I can't think of a better person. And one of the reasons, you know, I asked you to come on is today we're talking about issues, wellness, sobriety, and everything. And there's a big issue looming in hospitality, the wine world. We could look at it from the lens of the wine world, but the wine world touches everything. Hospitality,
sure.
Restaurants, retailers, workers, you know, farmers, everything. You've been to Washington. You've actually camped out a little down there.
I did.
Speaking on behalf of fighting the tariffs. So we need to set this up a little. There was a big uproar about Trump adding 100% tariff, but I think people forget that previous to that, he already slapped 25 on that were.
Sure.
So that's the setup. Now help me navigate through where things are, you know, what was happening when you're there and the
sure.
impacts. That's our discussion, you know, till.
Sure. I'm going to tell you the long story as fast as I can.
Okay.
Let me tell you the long story. This all boils down to a trade dispute that's been around for almost two decades, and it's a Airbus-Boeing trade dispute that is triggered and governed by the World Trade Organization in a thing called a 301 dispute. And it hasn't been used since the late 1970s. So the crazy thing is, like, nobody really understands exactly the rules of how we're dealing with this tariff issue. But it was originally heard by the United States Trade Representative, who ultimately makes all tariff decisions for the U.S., he and the president. They originally heard this in May and August. And basically what happened is the WTO gave the United States, they found in our favor, because the Airbus is receiving illegal subsidies from the European government, are unauthorized subsidies from the European government.
And that pissed the U.S. off?
Well, it's made us mad for 20 years.
Why? Right.
And it's made Boeing mad because
right.
They've lost growth and job opportunities and that sort of thing. So depending on how you look at it, you know, from what lens you look at it. But regardless, the USTR was given the authority by the WTO to impose tariffs on a variety of products, and those products included wine. And in May and August of this summer, they had hearings to decide whether the list of things that were on the proposed tariff list were authorized and efficient things to tariff. And unfortunately, the wine industry was not wasn't really paying too much attention. I mean, we're all, and certainly in my realm, we're small and independent, and we don't have people working on Capitol Hill, and maybe we don't even really pay attention a whole lot to that sort of politics. But again,
there's no big lobby for this.
It's also again like an action that hasn't been used since the 70s, so nobody was really sure about how what this meant and how it would work. Regardless, the tariffs were approved because they weren't really protested. Tariffs on wine were approved because they weren't really protested well or argued well why they shouldn't be at the in the summer hearings. And in October, yes, the U.S. trade representatives began imposing 25% tariffs on four countries from the EU, the four countries that are primarily responsible for those subsidies that the Airbus is hearing. But what really got our attention, but I can tell you this, when the 25% tariffs came into place, I, like most people, thought that this is an unfortunate piece of this policy, of this trade policy. But it's also, you know, we're going to do our part, and realizing very quickly that, you know, the U.S. is exercising their right because they think that they're right. And regardless what you think of the administration, this is something that's extended from Democrats to Republicans, and nobody wants Boeing, our American company,
to support the overall issue, right?
By this. So I felt like many, that, you know, this is our patriotic duty to some extent. And it seemed on the surface apparent that there's a countersuit between Airbus and Boeing, and Boeing and Airbus, and they're going to crash together sometime this spring and the tariffs would go away. But in December, the USTR announced that they were going to re-review this tariff package and potentially tariff wine at 100% from wine from every single country in the EU, which, once that happened, everyone in the wine world sat forward and started paying attention and realized that 25% tariffs are terrible, and it's not the greatest thing in the world to tariff for a variety of reasons. But 100% tariffs is a hospitality tax, it's a restaurant tax, it is the kind of prohibitive action that would really destroy an industry that's very valuable to the U.S.
Right, very widespread, you know, at every level.
I mean, not just money, but pleasure. You know, it's...
So that was a month or two ago?
That was December, I think it was 13th when they announced this potential 100% tariff.
And you made a bunch of trips down to Washington with a pretty good list of diverse people, and they finally stepped up, right?
We did. So December 13th happened, and in Charleston, I woke up and I was like, well, I always thought that the big guys would take care of us here, like somebody's watching this, but realized
when you say big guy, like, who were you thinking of?
The big Southerns and the giant wine companies and
or whatever, like they would flex and
that.
Did any of that happen?
Well, they definitely were working hard on it. But like I said, it's not a regular procedure that's handled this way. So, you know, I think in hindsight, none of us handled it right, because, you know, people like myself didn't even pay attention to what was going on in the spring and the summer, let alone do anything about it. And we didn't really do anything about it until after the 25-cent tariffs had been in place for almost 2 months, and they announced that they were going to potentially make them 100%.
Once you were backed against the wall, you fought back a little, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, when I import about 60% of our business comes from European countries. So from a personal standpoint, it was absolutely, you know, it's a do-or-die thing. If 60% of my supply chain is prohibitively tariffed and I can't make those wines unsellable, I'm obviously not going to stay in business very long. But then thinking about what this means for my friends and our customers that we partner with.
I want to talk to you about that, but sure. Answer these couple of questions first.
Sure.
So obviously when you and others went down and spoke, there was an impact where the decision was delayed. That's where we're at till December, or... Yeah, so did I say that right?
Kind of. The way the procedure works, it took a bevy of lawyers, even House committee lawyers from the trade subcommittee, spent a day and a half researching this, because again, like, nobody's ever used it, and they got to go through the rigmarole of figuring out what the exact procedures are. But when they implemented the tariffs in October, there was a mandatory 120-day review. So even though it looked like on December 13th, and coincidentally, December 13th was the Monday after the NATO conference where Trump and Macron and Boris Johnson and those guys were, quote unquote, making fun of Trump and the Saturday
Night
Live
skit.
And
right.
Hit that Monday, it looked like it was reactionary politics. But the reality was, it was something that was a procedure that they had to follow. So when they implemented the October tariffs, they had to review it in 120 days, which puts it in the middle of February. So, and then the procedure is they have to announce 60 days before they review something. They have to have a 30-day comment period, and then they have to sit on it for 30 days, and then they make the decision after that.
So when is it a time for you to worry? I mean, when does it resurface?
Well, so...
Or the time comes and a decision has to be made, whether to impose or... So when is that?
So we jumped in, obviously, and between December 30th and February... December 15th and February 15th, we worked as best as we could to figure out ways to try to stop the 100% from happening. And now that... And when February came, they announced that that they were going to keep the tariffs remain... what they originally did, the 25% on the limited countries, which is not a victory by any stretch, but I can guarantee you from my experience and the people that I talked to, that was never the intent. The intent was to maximize the pressure for the spring, for this next six-month cycle, and really try to get the Airbus case solved. And it would have been at the expense of the wine industry in a very, very devastating, wine and hospitality industry in a devastating way. But since they made the decision on the 15th, now, instead of 120 days, it's 180 days. So they'll review this now in perpetuity until they quit acting on this particular dispute every 180 days. So now we're looking at the middle of August.
Does that make it somewhat fluid? Like when that day comes, it may...
For one thing, this time we're going to be prepared, which we weren't before.
Different.
And we certainly are way better organized and we know how this works, but... They'll open up comments in the middle of June, they'll close comments in the middle of July, and then they'll make the decision in the middle of August.
Is it necessary for you guys to be back there for then, or it's not that type of...
Absolutely.
Okay.
And, I mean, the big thing that we're trying to do, and it totally makes sense, wine is not an effective tariff item, and it never should have been put on the list to begin with. Nobody wants to be tariffed. No industry does. We don't want to see cheese tariff. We don't want to see olive oil tariff.
Is that the champagne argument? If they tariff champagne, you can't replace sparkling wine is not champagne because it's so specific?
Well, there's two things that the USTR asked for when they asked for comments on tariff items. The first thing is, will it be effective against the target country? Will it create a pressure on them to acquiesce to whatever the dispute is? And in the case of wine, by and large, the answer is no. We are a replaceable market. It's European wine, and especially European fine wine, is a finite product. They make as much as they can. They sell as much as they can for a great profit. And they could sell it to Asia. They could sell it to China. They can sell it to Brazil that just eliminated tariffs on European wine for the first time in 30 years.
Really?
There's all kinds of markets that can replace the United States. And in fact, the month after the 25% tariffs went in place, France, which is the biggest country, obviously the exporter there and the one that was targeted the most, their exports grew the following month. Even though their exports to the United States dropped 50%, their overall exports grew. Chinese imports of French wine grew by 35%, and then the rest of Asia and other countries in Europe and South America took up the slack. So in that, you know, for that first piece of criteria, is it effective? You can look at the macroeconomics of it, and the answer is no. We're replaceable as a trade partner, and it can happen very, very quickly, and it did, and is happening very, very quickly. The second criteria that the USTR asks about is, does it do disproportionate harm to American businesses? And by virtue of the three-tier system that's mandated by the very Constitution of the United States...
So just quickly, explain the three-tier system. You threw that out.
So the three-tier...
In the wine and liquor world... There's a way wine gets from the producer to the consumer, and that's a three-tier system?
Right. So the three tiers for imported wines are, it has to go through an importer that has a federal import license. That importer has to sell it to a distributor like me that has a state distribution license, and then I have to sell it to a retailer or a restaurant who consequently sells it to the consumer. So you can argue it's a four-tier system.
And everybody's taking a little piece.
Well, everybody does their part and runs an important piece of the industry. It's also important to note that every level is taxed. So you get federal tax revenue, you get state tax revenue, and then you usually get, at the restaurant or retail level, you get more local tax revenue.
That's the consumer sort of getting screwed.
At the end of the day, I think that's
the cost of the business.
It's the cost of the business. And if it was, you know, sure, there would be some efficiencies if it was not regulated like that. But by and large, like, I stay pretty busy and I have to try pretty hard to sell wine, even though I am... occupying a space that is created by this by this system.
Right.
It would exist anyway. It would be a little bit more efficient perhaps, and it wouldn't be as much of a tax revenue generator as it was before. But the point is that for every one European winemaker that you harm in the tariff action, you harm by law, three American businesses.
The three-tier system.
So you're harming the importer, you're harming the distributor, you're harming the retailer, and at the end of the day, you're harming the consumer as well. When you buy, for every dollar of European wine or French wine, we'll use that as an example, for every dollar of French wine you sell, generally speaking, about 75% of that is American companies' either profit or tax collection.
That's a big chunk
of
it.
Crazy. So you're harming the French by a quarter, but you're harming America by 75 cents.
So spread out the question a little for me. So the question was, you know, explain the effects the tariffs are going to have. So one of the major ways, which is really the business of how wine gets here, is the three-tier system. It's going to affect those three players.
Right.
That goes all the way down to your local retailer and your restaurant.
Sure.
But let's go macro on that, because every one of those industries has a crap load of people.
Sure.
A retailer has store people. A restaurant has, you know, a ton of people.
Sure.
So how deep do you feel, you know, the effects are?
Well, I mean, no industry has a plan sitting or lying around for what happens if our cost of goods double overnight, which is essentially
right.
what we're looking at. You know,
it's
going to be devastating. But, I mean, in the case of wine, it's going to, it does make those products prohibitive. I mean, we already, you know, consumers already spend a lot of money on the things that they drink and enjoy. And they certainly would find other ways to get that enjoyment. But no one's going to pay $25 for a cheap bottle of Pinot Grigio, nor, you know, the people that are now paying $3,000 for a bottle of DRC aren't just automatically going to pay $6,000 because that's
no.
what it costs.
Right.
That becomes prohibitive. And so those wines, they figure out a way to get those wines and move them elsewhere. But yeah, you're right. I mean, jobs along the way, every way. And two, just a real loss of culture and enjoyment in the United States, because again, these things, it's not like
a big damper on
it. Like they just go up a little bit in price, they disappear from the industry. And once the new trade routes are built to the other countries that these products would go to, they don't just automatically come back to the United States. It's not like
right.
6 months later,
you're gonna lose a percentage. Okay. Right, there's no guarantee coming
right.
back. When a bunch of you were in Washington, I mean, you're part of that three-tier system, you're fighting for your life and all that. Were people good at articulating the effects beyond just your business? I mean, you could
right.
sit there and say, listen, I'm a local business, save that. I have a lot of people working for me, save that.
Sure.
But your product touches, you know, the restaurants, the retailers, all.
Right.
Were people good at articulating the depth of it?
I was really good at it.
You were. Okay.
But no, there.
So that, I'm going to read between the lines. Not everybody was, but I guess some others were, too.
Well, you know, there was... There certainly were a lot of people that were in D.C. talking the talk and doing the things. We started here in Charleston on December 13th, scratching our head, wondering what we could do. The government gave us the directive that we could comment to the USTR via their website, but that was really the only official thing that we could do to make our voices heard. So we started a movement where we solicited our congressmen for them to write the USTR, figuring that would give it more oomph, but also give us something to energize a movement to do something. So our congressman here, Joe Cunningham, was instrumental in helping develop that idea. But immediately it was a bipartisan.
And somebody in politics actually didn't frustrate you? They kind of helped you?
Lots of people did. I mean, honestly, that was the most surprising thing about the whole experience, was how really everybody and people on both sides of the aisle recognized that hurting hospitality, hurting tourism.
I think that issue is hard.
Cost jobs, and especially in a state like South Carolina, where tourism is our number two industry,
right.
And certainly in Charleston, when you look at this city and what it means to this city, you start running the dollars and cents. And
those people have to advocate for you the way they're supposed to.
So we were able to get support from both sides of the aisle very, very quickly. But it's not a legislative issue at this point. It's down this path through the administration and through the USTR. And so the trick became, how do we influence the USTR given the tools that we have?
Right.
And ultimately, what we figured out is who are the congressmen, who are the senators with the most access to the USTR, who has people that are now working on their staff that came out of the USTR office that could make that phone call directly to them and make the arguments that we need, that we wanted to, quickly and effectively. And we were very fortunate to develop relationships quickly, and in South Carolina in particular, have Congressman Tim Scott, Congressman Lindsey Graham, people that have
some sway.
Very favorable relationships with the administration that were also able to get the message to the USTR. So at the end of the day, the argument, I'm pretty sure, came down to not so much should we raise the tariffs on wine, but how can we maybe get wine off this tariff package eventually?
And right.
That's going to be our goal for the next review is hopefully wine will come off because of the two things that I mentioned. It's ineffective and it does undue harm to American business. And sadly, that's not the case with every industry. But for wine and spirits, that's the case.
Harry, we have to wrap up. What I want to do is you and I will stay in touch. And when things come to the next important time, I want to communicate with you one way or another. Call in, we'll tape something, you know, correspondence and all that. And you'll give me an update.
I will, absolutely. And, you know, this next time again, like I said, we're going to be better organized.
Well, it sounds like you got organized.
Right.
You're more aware. And next time we're not getting caught with our shorts.
Well, this time we know what to do, too, and we know what's effective. But we're gonna activate more restaurants. That's the biggest next step. I mean, obviously, importers and retailers, for them, it's a one-to-one ratio. But for restaurants and hospitality, it's a tiny bit more of a leap. But, you know, the number one group of wine salespeople in the United States are servers. They rely on the sales of beverage for about 40% of their commission, what we call tips.
Tons of them out there.
And this tariff is going to be prohibitively tariff about half of that. So when you start thinking about threatening 10 to 20% of the income of every server at every fine dining restaurant in the United States, it's impactful in a lot of ways, including a humanitarian way. But we started an organization called the U.S. Wine Trade Alliance. You can find it at uswinetradealliance.org, where you can sign up and be a member. And it doesn't cost anything. We'll take support.
Give me the handle again. U.S.
Sure, it's uswinetradealliance.org.
Okay.
And if you sign up as a membership, you'll get updates via email. We also have a Facebook page, group page, uswinetradealliance.org. If you're an industry professional,
We'll post it on our site, too.
You can answer like a few simple questions and get into the private group. And it's only private just to keep us from getting hammered by consumers and people that don't want to focus solely on tariffs, because that's really all we're focused on.
All right. On our podcast page, you know, I'll put that link up, too. We got to wrap up. I want to thank you for coming in and talking about an issue that, believe it or not, affects more people than they know.
Absolutely.
You know, we know the people in the industry are affected, but the consumer, too. One day they're going to wake up and go, you know, what the, you know, why is this wine, you know, they're so removed from the issue. So that's why I'll check back with you.
Well, my hope is they never will notice.
Well, yeah, that goes that way. I guess before we wrap up, congratulations in order. From the festival you received...
I did the Outstanding Beverage Professional Award for this year, which is
Have you ever won it before?
Never won it before.
And well, congrats on that.
I'm surprised.
All right, thanks for coming by. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network on tour. I'm Sam Ben Ruby from the Grape Nation. I want to thank Harry Root from Grassroots for sitting down and helping us decipher and navigate the tariff issue. Thanks again, Ben's friends, for making today's coverage possible. Stay tuned for more Charleston Wine and Food.
This program is powered by Simplecast.